the latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
With 35 years at the forefront of sports technology, Stats provides next-generation sports content for basketball, baseball, football, soccer. And now, Stats is turning its sights to horse racing. Racelens is the most in-depth product on the market. With innovative analytics powered by data from Equibase, it will change the way you follow horse racing. Stats Racelens, bringing clarity to handicapping. Learn more at stats.com/racelens.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Fun in the Sun is Express Vet's summer treasure. If you can't make it to the spa or where the turf meets the surf, do the next best thing and play Saratoga and Del Mar with Express Vet. And while you're at it, don't miss Express Bet's $120,000 Fun in the Sun Handicapping Competition. Play Saturdays by making a live $10 win wager on one horse in each of 10 competition races. Each week, top players collect $5,000 for first, $2,000 for second, $1,000 for third, and $500 for fourth. Plus, based on cumulative earnings throughout the season, the top four finishers will win a Pegasus World Cup Handicapping Championship seat, a $12,000 value each. Express Bet account holders register free once to play all summer. Don't miss this fantastic opportunity to shoot for some cool Fun in the Sun Saturday summer cash with ExpressBet, Saratoga, and Del Mar. Visit ExpressBet.com now to open an account and for complete Fun in the Sun details.
Account wagering is not permitted in all states. National Problem Gambling Support Line, 1-800-522-4700.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing, this is At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Back at the races, about 25 to the top of the hour. Tammy Piermarini having joined us, and you know, the more we talk, I got to find that picture that I put up on, I think it was on Facebook, right? Or maybe on Twitter. I had found a fabulous picture of, I think, at least eight, right? Who saw that picture? That's friends with me on Facebook. I've got to go digging around. I hate when I do that, but there's a fabulous picture of, I think, eight of the female riders outside the jock quarters at Suffolk. Steve Haskin joins us, and you know, one of the things that that Steve has chronicled in, among many, Cigar's exploits and the mass caps that at the time, you know, were big and big races, and certainly throughout history, as we, you know, gave off that list of winners of the mass cap, you know, historic list. Steve Haskin, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
You know, I had not remembered or realized that Skip Trial, that Sonny had already won himself a mass cap when Skipaway won his pair, right?
Yeah, Siren's son won.
Pretty cool.
Not only that, but Skip Trial had run it a few times. Skip Trial actually was in the mass. He was in the greatest mass cap ever run.
And
let me say that Skip Trial was in one of the greatest races ever won when Wal Coit beat Broadbrush, which was as exciting. No, nobody really knew much about Wal Coit, and Broadbrush was really, really getting good at that point. And, you know, all we knew about, you know, Wal Coit is that, you know, he was a Suffolk horse, and everybody thought Broadbrush would beat him. And I'll never forget that race because I was a big Broadbrush fan. And after that race, I became a huge Wal Coit fan. And I remember Wal Coit, he was a big, long-striding gray by Relaunch. And he went to the front in that match cap. And I remember he was pressed the whole way by a horse called Tour Dior. And Broadbrush was sitting third, right behind. Perfect setup race. And every time Tour Dior made a run at Wal Coit, he turned him back. And then when they turned into the stretch, there were three across the track, and Broadbrush moved up across the track. And at that point, he looked like he was 1-10 in that race to win at the quarter pole. And Broadbrush stuck his head in front in the stretch, and I couldn't believe it. Wal Coit came back at him. They hit the wire. There was absolutely no way in the world you could tell who won the race. And Wal Coit wound up winning by a nose and turned into, like, one of the toughest horses I've ever seen. I mean, he won the Suburban Handicap, and I remember when they ran him in the Jockey Club Gold Cup, and he was supposed to run against Ali Sheba. And I was an Ali Sheba fan, and so I didn't want to see either one of those horses lose. And it rained that day, and I kept praying that they would scratch Ali Sheba, and they did, because Wal Coit was an absolute mud lark. I mean, he absolutely loved it. And Wal Coit wound up winning by 15 lengths, and he wound up supplementing him to the Breeders' Cup Classic for $360,000. He's a $15,000 yearling. And they supplemented him to the Breeders' Cup Classic that year. And he set the pace, and he hung in gamely in the stretch, finished a very close third behind Ali Sheba and Seeking the Gold. I think he was beaten like a length. But he was an unbelievable horse. And I tell you, if you want to ever look for a trivia question, the trainer of Wal Coit, he was unlike any trainer I've ever met in all my years in horse racing. His name was Guido Federico. And when you spoke to him and you looked at him, he was the stereotypical Italian barber or Italian shoemaker. He was just like, he was with a mustache and the Italian accent, and he just looked like a barber. And he was the horse was owned by his cousin, Joseph Federico, but Guido was so unassuming. He was. I said, wait a second, am I talking to a trainer here of one of the top horses in the country? He was just a little an Italian guy with a thick Italian accent, with a mustache. You know, it was like everything you would think of, you know, just like you said, like an Italian shoemaker would look like. You could just picture him standing back there banging the heel on his shoe or something like that. And he's a trainer of Wal Coit. People forget that Suffolk Downs produced a lot of really, really tough horses. And, you know, one of the things, I've never been to Suffolk, so I don't have any, you know, remembrances of the track itself. I've been to Rockingham, but I just never, ever got around to going to Suffolk Downs. But I do remember one thing. When I used to go to Saratoga every year in the, like, starting in the late 60s, but mostly, like, through the 70s, my number one handicapping tool at Saratoga was betting 30-1 shots coming from Suffolk Downs. They were winning races at Saratoga. I mean, horses were paying, and they were under bet because they were coming from Suffolk. But they would come to Suffolk year in and year out and knock off all the big horses. I don't mean like in the Whitney or Travers or things like that. But, you know, allowance races, smaller stakes, any kind of stakes. When you saw a horse coming from Suffolk Downs, I don't care what its price was, because nobody ever bet the horses from Suffolk, no matter what. So they'd go off at 20-1, 25-1, 30-1. And their win record back in the 70s was incredible. They had a horse that used to come to Saratoga. And also, you talk about one of the toughest horses. You would think Suffolk Town's horses would be tough. They had a horse called Pension Plan, who he had some ridiculous record of finishing in the money. It was like, 50 out of 60 or something like that. It was some crazy record. But he was a tough sprinter. He wound up beating Prove Out. This is after Prove Out had beaten Secretariat and River Ridge, and he won the gray leg, and the Pension Plan knocked him off, and then Prove Out retired right after that race. But Pension Plan was just a tough horse. He actually won at the age of 11. He just kept coming year after year after year. But I vividly remember those Suffolk horses. I know. I tell you, maybe the best of all of them might have been Formal Gold.
Well, we had Mike Vesey, Bill Perry's nephew, just before Steve and Bill
Perry, one of the best trainers I've ever seen.
Yeah,
underrated. Maybe the most underrated trainer ever. I mean, he was so low key, so soft spoken, and just the nicest guy. But Formal Gold, oh my God. When he was an older horse, he was an absolute beast. And, the year Skipaway won the Breeders' Cup Classic, as impressive as he won, I'm not so sure. And he ran the fastest Breeders' Cup Classic of all time. But I'm not so sure he would have beaten Formal Gold, because Formal Gold had absolutely just crushed him the race before in the Woodward. And he did something that no horse has ever done. Is that he ran in three big races. He ran in the Whitney, and then the Island, and then the Woodward. And his buyer numbers in those three races were, if I remember correctly, 126, 124, and 125. I mean, nowadays he got a triple digit buyer. Wow, he got a 101 buyer. Wow, I mean, to run 120, 124, 125, and 126. In the span of a month and a half, three consecutive races. I mean, he was unbelievable. I remember him training for the Breeders' Cup Classic. Bill Perry hadn't gotten in yet. And he was with the assistant trainer and exercise rider. And every morning he'd come out on the racetrack and everybody literally would stop what they were doing. And they would look at this horse and their jaws would drop. This was before Skipaway had arrived. Bill Perry hadn't arrived. He was the king of the classic that year. And, Touch Gold was in that classic. And I remember one morning he was out there, and he was just a big, black, beautiful monster of a horse, just gorgeous. And I said, there's nobody, and I was a huge Skipaway fan, obviously. And I said, there's no way in the world anybody's beating Formal Gold. Nobody's going to beat this horse. He's just coming off of three 120 buyer numbers. Had beaten Skipaway by like five lengths in the race before that. And, Sonny Hine has had enough. He had took Shane Sellers off him and put Jerry Bailey up for the classic. But I'll never forget, I got to the barn one morning. This was at Hollywood Park. And I got to the barn one morning, and I go over to Formal Gold stall, and I see a vet in there with him. And I said, oh, Jesus, this is not good. But I said, well, maybe he's just giving him something or something. So I remember going over to the stall, and there is Formal Gold standing there with an entire leg cast on. From his top, from his ankle all the way up to his entire leg was in a cast. And I said, oh, my God. And I said, and the guy that was with him, and I said, what happened? He said, he fractured the leg, came out of his world. I forgot if he had worked or galloped the day before. He came out of it with a fracture. And Bill Perry was not there, and the owners were on their way. And they didn't know about it. They didn't. The kid didn't know if they knew about it or not. I said, God, I hope they know about it. I don't want to have to tell them. And I remember being at the barn when they arrived. They came in on the far end of the barn, and they had a little conversation with Chris McCarron. And I don't know if Chris had known about it. And they start walking towards the stall, And this guy got his fingers crossed. And he says, oh, please, God, I hope they know about it. I don't want to have to tell them. I don't want to have to tell them. And they came, and there's John Murphy was the owner. And before every race, he would sprinkle formal gold with Lord's water. You know, the blessing.
I've heard this. Before,
before every race, he would throw Lord's water on the horse. And he came, they started coming towards the stall, and his wife is carrying a bag of carrots, and they both have big smiles on their face. And he goes, oh, where's my boy? Where's my boy? And he goes, oh, my God, they don't know. And so she's got the carrots, and he's coming with this big smile on his face, looking for his horse. And he had to tell him. He said, I have bad news for you. You know, he's got a fractured leg. And his wife burst out crying, and just the sight of them feeding formal gold carrots with his leg cast on, and saying how much it hurts and how they can't believe it. And Bill just, you know, never came. But I had, you know, I had met Bill several times before that. He had other good horses too. But first thing I did was call him up and just commiserate and just tell him how sorry I was. It was about as gut wrenching a scene as I could remember. But Bill Perry was an incredible trainer. You know, I'm almost pulled off one of the great upsets of Breeders' Cup history in the mile.
With Northeast Bound, we've told that story, and the partners or our listeners, it's one of the great betting stories of all time. They had a ticket. It was the third race of the Breeders' Cup. They had gone all Northeast Bound on a pick three, and they would have taken the whole pool down. They would have made more money on the bet than they were going to make had he won the mile. Because of course Spain and Caressing had won the first two races,
right? Which Spain paid like $80 or something, $100,
incredible,
something like that.
Yes, they were insane prices, and they would take they found out later they had the only ticket, and I'm sure the money was one thing, but winning the Breeders' Cup Mile would have been, you know, and of course, you know, Bill was already suffering from the effects of the disease, and you know, was hard for him to work, but he powered on another 6 years actually after that.
Yeah, he was just so low keyed. I mean, you know, nothing ever rattled him. I mean, he just accepted everything. He was just a terrific guy. He really was. But if I remember correctly, I remember Northeast Bound was like down on the inside, and people weren't even looking at him anymore. And there was a horse in between, and then War Chant came flying up on the outside. And Northeast Bound would not go away. I mean, he was right there. It was like a three-horse photo, I think.
I just remember, my connection to it was Barbecue Bill Mayberry, who was very friendly with Bill. And, we were basically was the horse that Bill, you know, and we were doing the barbecue. We were busy with the barbecue, too. But the one thing that we were... I remember leading up to Breeders' Cup Day, the one horse that we were going to bet was Northeast Bound. So that's yeah. I mean, and we ended up hitting a lot of things, but it was the best Breeders' Cup I've ever had. It was one of the best days I've ever had at a racetrack, period. And frankly, we had two tough beats that day, despite all the success. You also had Point Given run into more trouble than could be believed for AP Valentine to prevail in the juvenile that day.
Yeah,
if you remember.
Oh, for sure. Well, yeah.
And it was also the day that Kona Gold broke through after you know, going what? Finishing fourth, then third, then second, and then winning.
Yeah, I think it was his fifth try. He ran the sprint five times.
And also that was Victor Espinoza's first. It was Victor's or Alex Solis? Either Victor or Alex Solis's first Breeders' Cup win, and of course, Honest Lady.
I think it was Victor. I think it was Alex's first.
I think that might be right, and because he had he was 0-for in the Breeders' Cup, had a rough record, and of course, Honest Lady was second.
I had Honest Lady. She was 30-1 that day, and
she was.
She was in front, one step past the wire. She was flying on the outside, 30-1. Bobby Frankel, Judmont. I couldn't believe it.
Yep. Well, do you remember who was third?
Let me see. Third. No, I can't.
Marty McGee remembers. Bet on Sunshine. His brother's.
Oh, horse. God, right. Oh, another tough horse, yeah.
Who we used. I used him. You know, he had finished third, what, two years earlier? Or
yeah.
Two years earlier.
Another come from behind horse.
And More Than Ready was fourth, except they didn't let us bet on Superfectas. I crushed. That's probably one of my single greatest race successes was that Breeders' Cup sprint. It was just a monster score, part of an amazing day. Anyway, I do want to do one thing, Steve. We've got queued up. You mentioned that MassCap, and so did earlier the conversation with Michael Blowen. He talked about Wacoit and Broad Brush.
Oh, you can watch it on YouTube, by the way. If you go on,
well, you're going to listen to it right now.
YouTube. Yeah, you off can watch of YouTube. It on YouTube. I implore everybody to watch this race. It's unbelievable.
They're going to hear it now, and this is Jim Hannon, I think, on the call.
You're waiting until you hear it. Wait until you hear his call at the wire.
Here we go.
He's absolutely berserk.
Go ahead, Joe. You can go ahead. That was fine.
Up in the match cap and down on the inside and title two. Goes to the top. Wacoit wants an early move. Takes over the lead. Wacoit, Tordor on the outside. On the inside and title two. After that, Broad Brush, Skip Trial. Creme Fraiche is sixth. They're into the turn. 7.5 furlongs to go. Wacoit a short lead. Tordor on the outside at second. Then it's Broad Brush on the inside and title two. Skip Trial and Creme Fraiche, and they move around the turn. Approach the 6 furlong pole with Wacoit the leader. Leads 3/4 of a length. Tordor is on the outside second. On the rail in title two. Outside of him is Broad Brush. Skip Trial on the outside is fifth. Creme Fraiche is sixth. They move up the backside at the 5 furlong pole. Wacoit the leader and neck. Tordor. Broad Brush with an early move goes 3 wide. Then it's in title two. Skip Trial and Creme Fraiche. They got a half a mile to go. Wacoit holding on to the lead and neck. Tordor second. Broad Brush a length back. On the outside, it's in title two. Skip Trial, Creme Fraiche is on the wood. A well-packed field past the 3/8 pole. Tordor been on top all the way, still has a head lead. On the outside, Tordor and Wacoit's on the rail. And on the outside, Broad Brush, Skip Trial on fourth. Then in title two and Creme Fraiche. They're into the stretch for the money. Three of them battle. On the inside, Wacoit. In the middle, Tordor. Broad Brush on the outside. They battle at the furlong pole. Now it's Broad Brush and Wacoit. Broad Brush a short lead. Wacoit hanging on the wood. Broad Brush and Wacoit. Look at him come. Ding, ding, battle in the rear. Wacoit and Broad Brush.
Yeah, he had no clue who had won that race.
You know? So great.
It was unbelievable that Wacoit would come back. I mean, he's a house horse, you got to remember. And Broad Brush was establishing himself as one of the best horses in the country. Certainly one of the best, definitely one of the best horses in the country. And it was really getting good at that point. And, Broad Brush was right there in all these big races. But this race was just unbelievable. And Wacoit just went from strength to strength. And I remember saying, what the hell is Guido Federico? And I remember when I met him. Because I remember I covered one of the first races I ever covered for Thoroughbred Times. That year was the Island that Wacoit ran in it. But he wasn't right for the race. I remember the, when I was talking to Guido Federico, he says he doesn't know if he's 100%. And he made it. It was one of the poor races. I think he finished third or fourth or something like that. We got beat by Wayne Lucas, who was winning everything in sight back then, beat him with a horse called Bordeaux Bob. But that was, I was crushed. I was looking forward so much seeing a Wackroyd after watching him win the match cap and then win the Suburban Handicap. It looked like he was going to be the next superstar. By the way, one quick thing before I go. You in the beginning you had mentioned Cigar, you know, in his first. That match cap was amazing. It was very historic in one regard. First of all, you know, they hadn't run the race for like 5 years or something.
That's
like
right.
That. They were
right.
Just bringing it back that year. And there was such a coup for Suffolk Downs to get Cigar that Cigar became the first horse ever to be given a police escort from the airport to the racetrack. And then, you know, all tracks started doing that. Like, for, you know, Derby winners would get police escorts, you know, in the Preakness and, you know, and horses, you know, would get, Silver Charm got a police escort, you know, to Belmont Park. I was on the van with him when he went there. But the first horse ever, no, it was unheard of. No, give a horse a police escort? Suffolk Downs was the first to come up with that idea.
That's got to be a Lou Raffetto.
It's got to be Lou Raffetto.
That's got to be Lou.
Only Lou could come up with that. You know, I mean, Lou was the greatest. I mean, he was just an absolute genius. He should have been like, Lou Raffetto should have been like the czar of racing.
Well, we're going to talk to Lou.
You know, he was unbelievable. But that made it, you know, and then Cigar wins the race, and then he wins the second year, and then Skip Away, and they gave him his police escort, too, and then Skipaway wins the next two runnings. So you have four runnings of it, both won by, you know, four runnings, won by two horses, two of the greatest horses, Cigar and Skipaway, and it really got that race back, you know, back on track. But, God, the horses that used to run in that race, go Whirlaway and Seabiscuit, and I remember when Riva Ridge won it. You know, it was a big, big race.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember when Riva Ridge won the match cap that same day, they were televising it. And on that telecast is when they showed the split screen between Secretariat and Cannonero. Just, you know, there was a big controversy on whether Secretariat had broken Cannonero's record. And I remember CBS, I think it was, showed a split screen to prove that Secretariat actually had run faster than but it was on the telecast of the match cap that Riva Ridge won, and Riva Ridge set a track record when he won that day. I think Skipaway wound up setting the track record in one of his mass cap wins. I think he still has the track record. I think it was like 147-1 or something like that.
Michael Blowen earlier, Steve, told the story of visiting Penny Chenery, and he went upstairs to the trophy room, and she said, "Don't steal anything." And he said the thing that he wanted to steal was the blanket, was Riva Ridge's mass cap blanket. That's what he would have stolen.
Even back then, Michael was looking for memorabilia. Now he's got live memorabilia.
Exactly. He's got a farm full of that's great. That's a great line. Well, we're going to talk,
you know,
Steve. Mikey.
Sad, you know, it was sad. It was sad when Rockingham Park went, and listen, a lot of terrific trainers came out of there. I mean, Ned Allard was one of the ones that would always go to Saratoga and knock these horses off. Vinny Blings, Carl Grussmark. It was a good horseman there. A lot of good jockeys came from there. You know, even though the track was small, it was not a major venue like New York or New Jersey or Florida. There was a lot of horses went for that that mass cap. Stymie won the mass cap, and I mean, a lot of good horses went there.
Yeah, it's an impressive list, and you know the satellite we talk about New England Racing very often. Given our some of the people that come through, and Mike Welch will be on tomorrow, and Mike particularly misses and appreciates the New England the scene, whether it's the places like the fair locations and Green Mountain, his favorite. I mean,
I've been to Green. I haven't been to Suffolk, but I have been to Green Mountain.
So have I, actually. It's funny you say
that. Believe
it
or not. My main recollection of Green Mountain, by the way, was betting. I looked at the tote board, and I loved the horse in there. I was there with my friend Joe, who was like the managing editor of the racing form, but he was one of my best friends. And he was staying up there, and I stayed with him before going to Saratoga. And we went there, and it was a horse on a tote board. He was 50-1. I said, what the hell is this horse 50-1? So I said, oh, there's no way in the world I'm not betting this horse. So I go to the windows, and I bet the horse. It was a small bet. I think I bet like $4 on him or something like that. I bet him, and then I go to the rail. I look at the tote board. He's 5-2.
Exactly.
I said, really? My bet lowered his odds from 50-1 to 5-2. You know, but, yeah, I mean, it was a fun night. You know, it's Green Mountain. It was gorgeous. It was in the Green Mountains. The whole area was absolutely gorgeous around there.
Pownall, the town.
Yeah, Pownall, Vermont, right. Yeah, not far from Saratoga, really. A couple-hour drive from Saratoga.
Well, and you know, the first place to have Sunday racing. They
exactly,
broke the,
right.
They broke the barrier.
Right. Very good, yeah.
And everybody would go over from, I should also get on here is Chick Matisse. Chick will he'll tell you some stories too. Well, Mike Arrow is
Green Mountain.
Green Mountain, big time, and Barrington too. I mean the Matisses they a couple of garbage bags of money had to be escorted out. But Mikey Arrow is going to join us next. We got Mikey coming.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
T.D. Thornton as well.
Oh, that'll be fun. Oh, that'll be a lot of fun. You talk about having stories to suck it down.
It's he wrote the book. He literally wrote the book.
Literally,
and you know who? We haven't even had a chance to bring in Bill Veeck. I mean, not that we can't really bring him in, but the Bill Veeck stories and.
Did you ever read the book? By the way,
500 tons a day.
What?
I've read Veeck is in Wreck, but what about his book about Suffolk?
Suffolk
about
Downs,
running?
Yeah.
500 tons a day. Or what? Or 50 tons a day?
Some of his promotions were absolutely outrageous.
Yeah, it's people in the '60s. He ran Suffolk.
He ran it. Was it the White Sox? Was it?
Yeah, the White Sox. And the St. Louis Browns.
And the St. Louis Browns. He came up with more crazy, innovative, wild ideas, and he did it in racing, and he did it in baseball. You know. He stayed some of these craziest things you've ever heard of.
It's 30, by the way. Lou Ruffetto reminds me, prompts me, 30 tons a day is the book that Veeck wrote.
30 tons a day, that's right, exactly right, 30 tons a day.
Which is the manure, the straw and manure that is hauled out of the track on a daily basis.
30 tons a day, right.
Steve, I got Mikey Arrow standing by, and I knew that you could fill in the you know that top line on the mass caps and some of the big horses, and that was fun to listen to Jim Hannon's call. And we're off next week, so when I talk to you next, it'll be opening day at Saratoga.
Oh wow, that's unbelievable!
How crazy is that? Are you going to be here for opening day, or are you waiting? A couple
not
weeks?
Opening day. I'll be there the 23rd for Wes is directing King Lear.
Oh, very good. Well, then,
you can meet Theo.
We'll meet Theo. That was such a cute picture of him looking forlorn yesterday. Steve, are you staying? Will you be there through the 25th?
Yeah.
Well, then I'm going to we're honoring. I've got the Captain Gala that I'm the MC for on the 25th.
What's that?
The Captain is a organization that works with troubled youth in the Capital District, and each Saratoga, usually that last Thursday of the month, we have the fundraiser, and it honors a horseman. And this year, we're honoring Shug and the 30th anniversary of the Summer of Easy Goer. So I would like you and Joan to come to that on Thursday night.
Oh, that would be nice.
Okay.
That was some summer.
When we discussed
the Whitney and the Travers.
Exactly. The Whitney Travers double, which will, I think it's fair to say will most likely never happen again. We're going to celebrate that.
Do you remember who did it before him?
Ooh, look at you. You're going to.
The 3-year-old that did it before him.
Yes.
I'll give you a hint. It was approximately 15. I'll tell you exactly.
74, 70.
17 years before that.
So that's got to be. Let's think about this. 70. 73, 74. I think you got me on this one, Steve.
I'll give you a hint. There was a horse that year that won 2 legs of the Triple Crown, and this horse was the champion 3-year-old.
Honest Pleasure?
No. No, before that, several years before that. 1972.
You got me on this.
Key to the Mint.
Oh, Key to the Mint. How about that?
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah,
he won
the Whitney, and he won the Travers. He also won the I believe he also won the Brooklyn against all the horses that year. And then he had a big showdown with Reaver Ridge in the Woodward that year. Woodward was a mile and a half that year, and he won, and the Key to the Mint won, and that sealed the 3-year-old championship.
How about you? All right. Yeah. That's a story into itself, actually. Might be worth that's Rokeby, right? Rokeby?
Yeah. That was one of their last really, truly great horses. In fact, Rokeby ran an entry. They, like they always did, Elliot Birch, and Mac Miller. But they ran their big filly in there, too. Summer Guest was in that race, too.
Summer Guest. Boy, you're pulling out. This is great, Steve. You got to save it for Saratoga.
What's that? Yeah, right.
Save it for Saratoga.
Yeah,
because otherwise, you're a steamroller. Have a great July 4th.
You open the door with the Whitney Travers double.
It is. It's my fault. Talk to you later. Steve Haskin, everybody. This is Haskin. This is why those columns are each one is a book. We're going to stay here because now we're in trouble. And we're in trouble because our next guest is one of the great horsemen out of New England who still plies the trade. And he's so much fun. Mikey Arrow joins us. And Mikey, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. You should have got that one. Your tax ticket was by Key to the Mint.
Look at you. How about it?
Keynote speaker was by Key to the Mint.
Is he really? I didn't even. That makes sense. Keynote. And Keynote, of course, my tax, as Mikey's referencing, when he came to Saratoga, my first IRS ticket, keynote speaker over Ballinar on Alabama Day. 1990, and I'm gonna. Now you're gonna make me pull up Keynote's the whole pedigree and record. Mike, all the New England trainers that used to come to Saratoga, you'd come out of Rockingham at that time of year, and all of us, as we learned how to play Saratoga, we were always taught to watch out for the New England shippers, and you were part of that group. I mean, talk about this, what you're thinking about and feeling with Suffolk closing after this weekend.
That's where I got started. That's where it all began for me, besides Rockingham. That's where I got my start. I was working for Floyd Duncan, and then Then when he passed away, he was a great two-year-old trainer. The two-year-olds could take his trainer. He was tough. You couldn't beat that guy. I think he had like 12 or 13 first-time starters win in a row, two-year-olds. He was unbelievable. Yeah, he was a great two-year-old trainer. And, yeah, that's all where it started for me. Yeah. And that's right. Steve's right about that walk, boy, broad brush. That was the greatest call down the stretch. Yeah, good memories. That was some good memories. Jim Hannon, he was a hell of a race caller. He was good. Then Bob Barrett to the wire.
How did you get on the track, actually? And I mean, were you going even before you got real interested?
No, my dad, he's been around since they had horse racing. In fact, he used to work for, he was on the contract to Frank Gilpin. That was an old trainer before my time. And let's see. They had a little riding experience and then got too heavy. And then, so, he moved his way up to New England. And then, my mom, she came from Haverhill, Mass, and then that was it. I mean, he was a hell of an exercise rider, too. Besides, you know, then later on he got his training license. But, he used to bring me to the track. I was pony and horses when I was 12 years old at Rockingham. In fact, one of them trainers said to me, I think it was Johnny Maioli, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going on that track. I got a couple posts out today." He just shook his head. Yeah, that was funny. But, I've been on the track since a while now. Yeah.
When did you go out and start to train and start to send them out in your name?
Well, I can tell you so many stories, Steve. When I was going to Haverhill High in Haverhill, Massachusetts, T.D. Thornton's father, coach, Paul Thornton. He was a basketball teacher and a health teacher. And then he knew I was, you know, helping my dad and everything. That's how we got hooked up. And me and Paul Thornton. In fact, one day I could tell you a real funny story real quick. We're at Haverhill High, and we headed down to Gansett. I have a Gansett with a filly called Lovely back. And they'd bring the station wagon and the two-horse trailer in the back of the parking lot. And they'd get me out of school, and then we'd head right down to Narragansett. They'd tell the teacher that Timmy was sick or something. He had to go home. And so we both shipped glasses. I had this English teacher. She says, "Well, give that $5 for me." She says, "Here's the $5. "What do you mean?" I said, "Oh, yeah, Pac. Yeah, he wants to pay $13. It's so funny.
TD's going to be on with us next, Mike, as it happens. Yeah. TD's 11:30, he's joining us.
He'll tell you. And then the other time there with Coach, we go on the Green Mountain, and his horse fell out up the Green Mountain. The horse fell out of the trailer. Yeah. Rolled down the hill. I said, "Well, this sucker's dead." It was in the newspaper. The stewards didn't believe us. The horse fell out of the trailer. The boop, boop, boop. They got all cut up. They were strict back then. And lo and behold, 2 weeks later, Box County wins it. Vermont.
Came back and won.
Oh, jeez. That ticket, 70. Green Mountain. Yeah. That's up. We got some good stories, too. But I had some good stories there. I had some good memories, a good start. You know. Those are good old days.
When did you make your move to out of New England down toward Mid Atlantic?
let me see, 15 years ago? Jimmy Pambianchi says, well, it looks like Suffolk. He said, Mike, you better make a move. I owe it all to Jimmy Pambianchi, too. He also told me, he said, Mike, he said, it's going to get a little slow over here at Suffolk. So he says, if you can stay where you're at, you're better off. He was right. They closed up for a couple of years, and then I was glad, you know. Yeah, but it's a shame, you know. That's why I like to go up there. But hopefully this weekend I don't come out with the goose egg. I really have my head down.
Are you going to run? You've got. I haven't gone through the entries that close yet.
Three. Yep.
Well, everybody is going to want to get one last photo this weekend.
Everybody.
Well, you know what? I don't know if you realize it. We had Mike Vesey on, Bill Perry's nephew. You're in the Bill Perry race. That seventh race Saturday.
Oh, great. Good. That'd be nice. Yeah. In fact, my friend, his assistant there, John Cole, he's coming, he says. He's the one that let burn. John Cole. Yeah. No, that'd be good. That'd be nice. In fact, I'm packing up very shortly and head up to Suffolk.
Well, you've got, you got Freudian Fall and driver's license on Saturday, and she read my texts on Sunday.
Yes, she read my texts. He should be all right. Driver's license, I don't know. I think he better take another driver's test. And the other one should be all right, Paul. This condition should hit him. He should be good. So, 2 out of 3, I think.
All right. Mikey, we don't know what the future is going to be. We're going to talk to Lou Raffetto as well here.
Lou, he's got a good plan, I think. I just hope that he make those turns a little bigger because. I don't think the riders today will want to go to Big Barrington. Yeah.
You're talking at over at Barrington, you mean?
Yeah. Oh, jeez. Yeah, that's another time. That was great. Yeah, great. Good times. Good times.
Well, Mikey, we'll see you over there on Saturday.
All right. But, yes, Steve. Make sure those restaurants that the top shelf. Don't mind the secondhand stuff. So.
Yeah, they
got all the connections. You got all the connections.
You're the best. I appreciate it. Mike Arrow, everybody, and I hope he gets a picture with the one. I mean, there's so many people that are going to be. Trying to get that win this weekend with these last opportunities. Let's take our last break of the morning. We got to get one more in so that Joe can chop things up for the archives. And when we come back, T.D. Thornton. And little did T.D. know that his father would be invoked in advance of his visit. Paul Thornton. It's unbelievable. That's the kind of community they had in New England. When it came to the racing, take a break. And T.D. Thornton, the author of Not by a Long Shot, if you want to get the most recent look at Suffolk and its place in racing. Back after this with T.D.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
DRF Sports Forum Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sports Forum delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsforum. Enter code DRF Sports.
Career track are you on? University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Do you ever wonder what happens to your old friends, including the great champions that inspired unforgettable memories, and maybe even let you cash a ticket or two over the years? We even have a former child prodigy.
Here is a superstar. That horse's name is Afternoon Delights, and Kit the Sermon Afternoon Delights, absolutely galloping in the Hollywood Futurities.
These are the champions that help out the horses that might not have won a Grade 1 race, but always tried just as hard. Come visit them all at Old Friends when you're in Kentucky or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-9
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're back about 28 after into hour three here, and he's going to be surprised, but he's technically the second Thornton to appear on the show because TD joins us, the author of, not by a long shot, A Season at a Hard Luck Horse Track. But TD, I don't know if you had a chance to listen, but your father has already come up on the show today.
Oh, really? I did not hear that. How was that? How did that fit into the mix?
Well, who could invoke your father at off the top of your head?
I'm guessing Mr. Raffetto.
Mikey Arrow.
Oh, Mike Arrow. That's great. Mike, did he tell the story about how he was a groom for my dad back in the early 70s?
A little bit, yes, a little bit.
Mike was a high school. My dad was among all the various other vocations that he juggled throughout his career, being an NCAA basketball referee and a restaurant owner and a high school. He was also a high school teacher, and Mike was one of his students. And he got Mike a job as a groom back in the early 70s at Rockingham Park. It was his first gig, I believe.
Very much, and he told the story about hustling down to Narragansett, and one of the teachers slipping him $5, and I guess your dad made up an excuse that he had to go home because you were sick, and
I'm sure there are a lot of stories like that, some of which only might be fit for telling on the air. But yeah, that sounds right.
they told the story about going to Green Mountain and the horse falling out of the van, out of the back.
Yes,
of the...
that was a horse that was in I believe it was in 1970 or 71. Too young for me to remember, but my dad has told that story enough times. The horse's name was Box County. And they were driving, and apologies if Mike's already told you a good deal of this, but in summary, they were going out to race at Green Mountain, and the fastest way to get there was the old Route 2 in Massachusetts.
Sure.
And in North Adams, Massachusetts, still today, there's this very dangerous hairpin turn. And they went around the turn in an old trailer, and the horse didn't like it, and the horse kicked the bottom, the back end of the trailer out, jumped over the guardrail, and was down in like a gully. And there was they led him up to the back to the guardrail. The state police arrived on the scene, and they couldn't get the horse to step back up over the guardrail, even though he had jumped over it the first time in his fight or flight instinct. So they had to walk him all the way back down in a mosquito-filled night in the middle of August, and they found some farmer who had dogs barking and coming after Mike and my dad as they were trying to get the horse into some shelter so they could drive the van down. It was a story that probably was not very fun when it happened, but in the retelling, it grows better and better each time my old man tells it.
Well, and Mikey said he two weeks later he came back to win.
Yeah, that's right.
there always has to be a win at the end of these.
Whether there is one or not, some always find its way into this telling after almost 50 years.
Well, your book, which we talked about at the time it came out, and, even then we knew there was an uncertain future, and there was hopes, of course, for the gaming license, that was foisted out from under them. And, here we are at the finish line. TD, you've spent so much time at Suffolk in the announcer's booth and helping the track publicity end the things. I mean, talk about your thoughts and feelings with these last 2 days in sight.
Coming into the last 2 days at Suffolk Downs on Saturday and Sunday, I think the big thing that I want to underscore for anybody who's able to come out to the races in Boston, or even if you're watching on simulcast, I consider my job as the track announcer and the voice of New England racing right now to make sure the track gets the most respectful and honorable and fun send-off that we can give it in the last couple of days. If you're coming out to the races at Suffolk this weekend and you expect a funeral type of atmosphere and me delivering essentially a eulogy from the announcer's booth, that's not going to happen. We're going to go out on a high note. Suffolk Downs has been too good to me and my family for many, many decades for me to be crying in my beer, and I'm just going to do the best that I can to give it a good send-off, and when I walk out of that announcer's booth on Sunday evening, I'm going to do so with my head high and full of a lot of great memories. It's really a miracle. What we're celebrating is the fact that the track has stuck around as long as it has, because for decades, rumors of its demise have been both real and imagined. Suffolk Downs has had more comebacks than Lazarus, and It's really a testament to what a great run it's been for 84 years. So that's going to be my role in this as we wind it down.
Well, so many people coming from as far away as can be managed to pay respects. Tina and I are looking forward to being there, and gotta reach for your vast and really a repository of memories, a lot of which made it into the book, obviously, not by a long shot. For those that haven't read either this or the Bill Veeck book, 30 Tons a Day, what is the takeaway, do you think, TD? What should people know about the history of Suffolk?
I think that, Suffolk Downs underscores the minor leagues of horse racing. It even though we've had some high points in terms of the mass cap, our one big day, almost like Cinderella, where we got all dressed up for the ball and we put on a good show in the years that Cigar came back in back-to-back years in 95 and 96, didn't skip away in Barron's. We were known for putting on a good major league show. And my rise through the ranks in the racing industry, I was fortunate enough to have it coincide with the rebirth of Suffolk Downs in 1992 after it had been closed for 2 years. And it was so much fun just being a part of an underdog team where we were, we stood out as a little track that could. And there was always the promise of possibility there. And what I tried to underscore in the book, Not By a Long Shot, is that you know, there's the glitz and glamour of horse racing. A lot of people think it's the Triple Crown races and the Breeders' Cup and champions of the sport and the titans in terms of trainers and jockeys. But to me, racing is always going to be about the hard scrabble, ground level, grassroots type of racing that you have at tracks all across the country. And at urban racetracks, especially, they're disappearing off the map. So I think when people, as we've been winding down and coming up to the grand finale here at Suffolk Downs, a lot of people have been asking me for my memories and recollections, and I think it's surprising to a lot of people where I don't point out, to me personally, big races or great horses, but the thing about Suffolk Downs for me, having worked there for 27 years, first and foremost is the lifelong friendships that you made with people. I'm never going to forget that. And it's not big races and big horses, but it was things like being able to go to my job every day for 27 years, whether it was as the track's publicist, being on the PR team, or now as the track announcer. And really, Steve, never once did I think of going to my job as work at Suffolk Downs. And that's something not a lot of people have the privilege of being able to say with whatever their vocation is. So I feel very privileged in that sense. And it's things that will always stick in my mind, like arriving early in the morning at the track. You know, for people not familiar with Suffolk Downs, it's in a really gritty, hard scrabble section of East Boston. It's not a very pretty section of the city. And you would drive through, these neighborhoods and these huge, toxic-looking oil tanks that front the big roads that leads to the track. And then you'd arrive at Suffolk Downs in the morning, and it would just be this green oasis that you would see as you walked into work to go do your job. You'd come up through the grandstand seats, and all of a sudden this big 200-acre green jewel of the track and its infield with hundreds of thoroughbreds in the morning. And off in the distance would be the Atlantic Ocean, Massachusetts Bay, sparkling in the morning sunlight. And it never got old for me, just coming up and seeing that every morning when I went into work. And it was almost breathtaking, even in the last days. I still do that as I'm coming up, and I expect to do it on Saturday and Sunday. Just that first view of the track, that oasis of green and blue with all the horses out there. And, you know, I remember things like, I will carry memories like the daily interactions I had with the wacky cast of characters that you can only get at an urban type of racetrack. People that you met and saw every day, and you might not have even known their names for decades, but you would have interactions with these fans, the people who showed up. We have a very loyal fan base here in New England, and just being privileged to be a part of those people, it was always something wacky happening that would never happen to you on a 9-to-5 type of job. As for specifics, two things that really stick out in my mind. One of them was when we first brought Cigar to the Mass Cap in 1995. He was quickly becoming the hottest horse of the decade. Everybody wanted a piece of Cigar. They wanted him to race at their track. And we managed to not only lure him there in 1995 with a bonus system, but we got him back in 1996. And just the fans being so grateful that even though Cigar was 1-to-10 in the betting, just to see him canter around the track and a true champion there. And the first time that Cigar ran at Suffolk Downs in 1995, we ended the day late in the press box finishing up our work. All the crew in the press box and track management, we went out to dinner. And then we came, a very late dinner, and we came back, and it was about midnight to go get our cars in the track parking lot. And it was me, Larry Colmus, who was the announcer at the time at Suffolk, and Chip Tuttle, who now is the chief operating officer of Suffolk Downs, but he was the head of the publicity team at the time, and a couple of other guys. And we said at midnight, let's go see the champ. And we all went down to the backstretch at midnight. There was a security guard guarding Cigar's stall, and we knew the guy. And he let us come in, and we fed Cigar some handfuls of hay, a couple of treats, got to pet him on the nose. And just the privilege of being able to do things like that, that's going to stick out in my mind. The other thing, you mentioned my dad, who was a trainer for 40 years in the New England circuit. He's now retired. But the other thing that I'll always remember, when I was the announcer at Suffolk Downs and my dad was in his heyday as the trainer and he was doing well enough to, he won an award from the New England Turf Riders for the most success with a small stable. He never had more than 20 horses at a time. But my dad and I, nobody ever knew about this, and I've never really told this story, but my dad and I whenever he had a horse in, I generally did not bet the Suffolk Downs races when I was announcing, a little too much on the brain to be able to handle both tasks at once. But I, whenever my dad had a horse running, I would watch it specially in my mind, just because you want the horse to get around the track healthy and everybody to be okay. And win, lose, or draw, after that race, every time when my dad would walk back from the grandstand area where he would talk to the jockey back to the stable area, we would just have a hand signal. I would look down at him, and he would give me, we call it the wave, and he would just give me a little hand signal with his hand just to let me know everything was okay. And even if the horse finished up the track or my dad was in the winner's circle getting his picture taken, he was so even-keeled. And just to know that we could be a part of this and we could share that little signal, he would raise his hand to me. Nobody else could see it. And I would kind of wave back to him from the announcer's booth. Being able to do that with your dad and to come up and do a job that you love and be a part of this great sport and do it with a family member like that, those are the memories that I center on that I'm never going to forget.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's funny, by this point, obviously you're an adult, but, you know, one of the things that Suffolk helped usher in in terms of eras, it was Bill Veeck that petitioned to allow children to come to the racetrack.
If anybody wants a great read, I would suggest Bill Veeck's book, 30 Tons a Day, which the title is kind of a double entendre between that's the amount of manure a racetrack like Suffolk Downs had to dispose of on a daily basis, but the 30 tons a day also refers to the amount of manure that Bill Veeck felt he had to endure from the Massachusetts politicians, who are a ruthless bunch. And he really rubbed people the wrong way. You know, he would come into these racing commission meetings in 1970 when he took over the presidency of the track, and they would say, well, you can't do that. Whatever he would ask for, they would say, you can't do it. And he would say, why? And they said, because it's always been done the way that we do it. And he fought and he sued the Massachusetts Racing Commission at the time to allow children to come to the track. He had a young son himself who was a teenager, and he said, I'm not going to work in any job where my own son can't come and see me at my job. And Bill Veeck, you know, maybe if you don't know Bill Veeck, he was a baseball promotions maverick, and he owned baseball teams as far back as the 1950s. And he took a break from owning baseball teams and ran Suffolk Downs, and he only lasted 2 years. They kind of ground him up in the Massachusetts legislature, but those 2 years he had enough to write a book about it. And that's one of the stories, how he sued the Racing Commission, and I think other states followed suit after that precedent was set and they allowed kids to come into the track.
Exactly. And, you know, it's one of those unknown legacies. And, you know, there's other things about Suffolk. I mean, we've already touched on the historic aspect, including Seabiscuit coming and winning a mass cap. But then there's also some things that undoubtedly, you know, Boston residents and, you know, teenagers at the time, the last U.S. appearance of the Beatles at Suffolk Downs.
Yeah, that was in 1966, and you know, what had happened in that era was a couple of towns away from Suffolk Downs in Lynn, the Rolling Stones had played a concert at a baseball field a little bit before that, and people were, you know, I guess things got out of hand, and people were worried about a near riot type of condition. So there was all this, you know, trepidation and anxiety about would the Beatles set teenage girls and off into a frenzy because of their appearance in Boston. So they really beefed up security for the Fab Four, and it did turn out to be one of their last U.S. appearances. You know, you can still see tickets for that, unused and even partially used tickets for the event for sale on eBay. So that was a big moment. That was a little bit before my time, but it's etched into the history of the track.
Well, TD, the book you hit on, and it's actually been a few years. How old is the book now that I'm thinking about it?
Not by a long shot. Came out first in 2007, and wow. Coincidentally, it came out the very same day that track management changed hands. That the ownership of the track changed hands. I had written Not by a Long Shot based on a journal that I kept during the 2000 racing season. And it took me 6 years to write it and find a publisher for the book. And I was fully prepared when it came out because some of the topics in the book are controversial and really unvarnished. And I had fully expected that I would lose my job at Suffolk Downs as the tracks announcer when the book came out. But I was willing to take that risk. And the book came out on April 2nd, 2007, the very same day a sale was announced of the track to its current ownership group. And I got a phone call from a gentleman who was the general manager at the time. He's now deceased. And it was a couple weeks after the book came out. And I said, I recognized the caller ID. And I said, this is it. This is my termination phone call. And the gentleman proceeded to get me on the phone and say that he loved my book, and in fact, he was buying up a case of them to give to the new ownership group to see what they were really getting themselves into. So I was kind of surprised that I was spared the ask there, and the book has lived on, and so did I.
That's a good aside too. I mean, in terms of living on and certain memories. And I had Tammy Piermarini earlier, TD, and I brought up the late Jill Jellison. There are any number of people. Mike Vesey was on with us, and we talked about Bill Perry. Certainly a Suffolk appreciation has got to include Rudy Baez.
Yeah, Rudy Baez was really the rock of the Suffolk Downs jockey colony for many decades. And he's a name that a lot of, to people not familiar with New England racing, they might not know who Rudy was, but as I chronicled, he was one of the storylines in Not by a Long Shot, and Rudy was the leading jockey at Suffolk Downs for many years, and he was a guy of tremendous religious faith and tremendous work ethic, and you would find Rudy between races reading his Bible in the jockey's room, and whenever he would win a stakes race, which happened every weekend, it seemed, you would go down to get one of his quotes on the publicity team, and it was always, first, I thank God for giving me the opportunity. And Rudy was involved in an accident at Rockingham Park in August of 1999, and he was racing in a tight formation. His horse clipped heels, and he was thrown to the track head first, and Rudy became a paraplegic because of that. And in all of his treatment and his rehabilitation, he was in New Jersey at a noted rehabilitation center for months, and he was in fact even in the same room that Christopher Reeve, who was played Superman in the movies, the actor, he was also paralyzed in a horse riding accident, and he was in the same room that Christopher Reeve had been in, and I believe Mr. Reeve even came and visited him. But Rudy wasn't the type of guy who needed inspiration. He gave inspiration to others. He repeatedly, as soon as he was able to talk after his accident, say that, hey, I'm going to bounce back from this. I'm just going to be Rudy sitting down in a chair. And he, within 8 months of his accident, he was at Suffolk Downs, and we had a Rudy Baez day. And he was there in his wheelchair, and he wore a suit, and he insisted on, to this day, he insists on pushing himself around in the wheelchair. He's not in a motorized wheelchair. His arms are extremely strong, and of course, they were strong from being a jockey. And one of the things that we chronicle in the book was Suffolk Downs management very quietly in that 2000 racing season, 8 months after his accident, bought him a special vehicle with hand controls for the gas and the brake so that he could get around. And, that's really something that the track didn't publicize. And it was very, even though Suffolk has a reputation as a hard-knocking, hard-scrabble racetrack, those were the little kindnesses the track management would do for people and still do to this day right up until the end. And they don't seek publicity for them. And it didn't really get out until I wrote about it in Not by a Long Shot. But Rudy, you still see him. He's still on the list of officials. He works down in the jockey's room. And he was the guy who, when you think of the jockey colony at Suffolk Downs in the 1980s and 90s, he was the man.
The sense of community is particularly strong, and I mean this is true in any hotbed. When you go to Hot Springs, and there's that community from Arkansas, and obviously in Kentucky, and in every in every area. But it is remarkable, TD, that the people that grew up in and around racing in New England, and it's always New England becomes inclusive because, as you've referenced, and everybody that's been on today, and certainly everybody that'll be on tomorrow, Rockingham has come up, Narragansett, Lincoln Fields, the Fair Circuit, Green Mountain. It's a much wider. The only place that wasn't mentioned I can think of so far today is Scarborough in Maine, and I guess Plain Ridge too, and the dogs. For some reason, the dogs didn't come up at all today. But the sense of association with New England racing is that has not died at all. And even if things don't work out at Barrington, I mean, the people that grew up around the game from the New England area, they're just incredibly loyal, and they speak with just an incredible reverence for their upbringing in and around the sport. Whether it was in Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, New Englanders, we can be a kind of a cantankerous lot, and we squabble a lot amongst ourselves. But, boy, do we really defend what we have to the outside world. It's it's really difficult for me to articulate that. It comes from, I think, New England having such a strong connection to the horse itself, going back to colonial times. No offense to the people in Kentucky, but long before Kentucky was founded, New England was considered the epicenter of the horse world for America. And there was racing in the streets. There were trotting parks when harness driving became both a recreation and a sport. And as you mentioned, the New England circuit, two tracks in Rhode Island, a couple in Massachusetts, Vermont, Maine, a very robust second-tier fair circuit, and a lot of good New Englanders. When you look back at the histories of people who have gone on to bigger and better things on a bigger stage in the racing industry of North America, got their starts in New England, and they are fiercely loyal to it. And outside of the horse community, the fans themselves are just so loyal and steadfast. I mean, I think a lot of people from other parts of the country know a little bit about what how sports crazed a town Boston is. And, you can have the same people. When Cigar would come to the mass cap and Jerry Bailey rode on the undercard and didn't hit the board on a couple of 3-5 shots, the fans were lining the paddock, razzing him and giving him crap for it. But yet they still appreciate the wonder and the magic of a good thoroughbred. And when he came out for the mass cap on Cigar, they could do nothing but line the rail 5 deep and cheer the horse itself. So, we're a very demanding lot as far as being New Englanders, but we also know when we have a good thing and we appreciate it.
I also, we mentioned Baez, and I told you Tammy Piermarini was on, and you think about the riders that came out, the McCarrans, and you think about the handicappers that were produced. If they weren't New Englanders by birth, they had their moments. Certainly Steve Crist and Andy Beyer, and I should throw Mike Watchmaker in, because Watch loves to tell stories of going to the fairs but certainly Crist and his writing, and Beyer and their days at Harvard, and going to Suffolk and to the dog track. There's no area of the game, TD, that isn't represented when you tell these stories and you think about the tangents that the racetrack reaches.
Yeah, there's you throw the stone in the pool and there's a lot of ripples that aren't evident to people, and it's kind of hard to get your head around, at least for me, that Boston, I believe, maybe you could say Atlanta. I'm not sure what the population of Atlanta is, but Boston in New England will now represent, after Suffolk Downs closes, the largest, most populated geographic area in the country without access to live racing. And that's really the shame in all of this. that there is not, you know, the closest track to Boston at once Suffolk Downs goes dark is going to be Saratoga. Obviously, that's like comparing apples and oranges. But it's hard to believe that racing will be sliding off the grid in an area that is so respectful and, you know, has such a high regard for the horse. And these people are huge sports fans, and they bet pretty robustly. You know, there's tens of millions of dollars accruing in this racehorse development fund that is waiting to be paid out in purses. And the cruel irony of the casino legislation that's happened in Massachusetts is unlike anywhere else in the country, in that there is tens of millions of dollars available to run for purses. There is now going to be no racetrack at which to run those races.
Well, tomorrow when Lou Raffetto joins us and we'll get an update on what the prospects are potentially for the rebirth at Barrington, and that would go over well. And granted that, you know, it's Western, that's about as Western Mass as it gets, but it would still qualify. But you really, you know, brings up a great point, TD, and it's always the counterpoint that I make when people say, oh, we don't need these C tracks. We don't need Fairmont. Oh, really? Well, if we lose Fairmont, people in St. Louis have no racetrack. Losing Suffolk, Boston and Hartford and, you know, and greater New England that has no place to see live racing. And for the people that say, oh, well, it's such low quality. Well, the first time you go to a racetrack, you don't know the difference between a $5,000 claimer and American Pharoah. I mean, you just, it's the pageantry and it's the, you know, it's the whole spectacle that engages you, and it isn't the level of quality. And certainly Suffolk as a facility never wavered in what a bright, you know, clean, well-lighted place it was.
Yeah, you know, and to speak to your point about how a track like Suffolk Downs fits into the overall fabric of our nation's racing, you know, there are going to be some 20,000 horses bred in North America this year. Little more than that, maybe. Maybe the number's 21 or 22. And only 20 of them are going to make the gate 3 years from now in the Kentucky Derby. And all the ones that don't make the Derby and the Breeders' Cup, they've got to go somewhere else. And that's why we see, you know, to widen the lens even further, look what's happening in the bloodstock market. People are bemoaning that the middle part of the market has fallen out. And it's been that way since the recession of the late, you know, 2008, 2009 era. And it's driven a lot of people, a lot of mom-and-pop breeders, people who, you know, raise one yearling and bring it to the sale, and they hope to make a big score. And for them, a big score is $25,000. Not very big in the bloodstock world, but you take all those people out of the equation, and it goes hand-in-hand with taking all the Suffolk Downs and the Portland Meadows, which is also, you know, slated for demolition. You take those tracks out of the equation, there's not going to be no middle market in as far as racing venues. People talk a great deal about contraction of racetracks, that we need fewer racetracks. Well, you know, when a place like Suffolk Downs or Portland Meadows goes out of business, it's not a zero-sum equation. Not all of the participants in the racing industry are going to go to, for example, here in New England, some of them might go to Parks, or they've already gone to Parks or Delaware or Finger Lakes. Some of them are just going to get out of the game entirely. They don't all automatically all transfer over to another track. Some people want to race and do it almost as a hobby. Some people do it to grind out a small living, but they want to do it where they live. And not a lot of people want to uproot their families and go move to Finger Lakes or Delaware Park or wherever else. And I think that's the real shame. You know, you can't look at Suffolk Downs closing in a vacuum. You've got to look at it as part of the wider fabric, and that's what we see going on throughout the country.
T.D. Thornton, the author of Not By a Long Shot, as well as My Adventures with Your Money, which is a fun tale as well. Buy them together right now. Go to Amazon or wherever you buy books, and get both of T.D.'s terrific books. And T.D., we'll see you Saturday. You have kept the spirit of Suffolk out in front of horse players and fans for years, and well done. I appreciate this visit.
All right, Steve, looking forward to seeing you. We're going to have a great weekend out there. We're going to send the old gal off in style.
Big time. T.D. Thornton, everybody. Want to thank him and Mikey Arrow. Steve Askin, Tammy Piermarini, Mike Vesey, Dick Powell, and Michael Blowen. We'll do more Suffolk appreciations woven into tomorrow during the weekend preview, and it's a big weekend. Queen's Plate and so much more. Some good racing today. Good luck if you're playing. HRRN coverage here on Sirius XM, 3 o'clock. Back with you live tomorrow, 9. Archive, podcast, at the website as well. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.